We will call a meeting to order, the State Government Finance Committee meeting for January 26th, 2012. Happy New Year to everyone. Welcome back. We want to welcome, a special welcome to our newest member, Representative Neelene. And welcome, thank you for being here.
She's a ranger, watch out, Maury.
Yeah. We're used to dealing with the rangers, they're good folks. And I told her if she wanted who wanted to know who to watch out for, just check with me out.
I think he'll lead you astray.
You have before you the minutes of our December 6th meeting. Would someone move those minutes?
I move minutes.
Representative Erdahl moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. The first item we have on the agenda is something we've already done. But we have to officially run it up the flagpole again. Representative Downing. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is House File 545, and I would move passage of House File 545 to be placed on the general register.
Okay, you've heard the motion. We took testimony on this previously, and so we don't take testimony today. Do you want to explain why it is we have to take this additional step at this point, Representative Downey? Or
Mr. Chair, yeah, thank you, and I'll ask staff to correct me if I get it wrong, but the process between adjournment of the first year of the biennium and commencing the second year of the biennium is that bills return to the place of their last passage or jurisdiction, and so the bill, even though it passed this committee, is now back here to start off the session in this year of the biennium.
Okay. No, we didn't. Any questions or discussion? If not, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carried. Now we have a series of reports that we need. Members, there's a long list of reports that were due recently or due in the next short period of time. And it's important that we hear from those reports, so there's follow-up on action that we took previously. We were able to schedule a number of them for this morning. There will be many more as we go along. And I want to remind everyone that we will need to, again, really try to start our meetings on time because we will have a full agenda each and every time we meet. And I want to also prepare you for the possibility of needing to have an evening or two meeting along the way in order to get our work done, especially if we're going to stick to trying to get the legislative session wrapped up sometime in April. So with that, the first report we're going to receive is the update on the state job classification study. We have a couple of folks who are going to present that, Ann O'Brien and Lori Hansen, from both from MMB. So if you would join us at the testifiers table. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Would you each identify yourself, and then I don't know who you're going to have go first. But
thank you. My name is Ann O'Brien. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am the Assistant Commissioner for Human Resource Management at Minnesota Management and Budget.
And I'm Lori Hansen. I'm the Human Resource Management Director at Minnesota Management and Budget.
Well, I am new to the role of Assistant Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, I have several years of experience in human resources with the state of Minnesota as an HR director in a variety of state agencies. We are here today to discuss several reports with you, and we hope you find this information useful, and we appreciate the ability to discuss these items with you. We are always striving for improvements in how we manage the workforce in conducting the business of the state, so these reports assist us in looking at these issues in a broader context. The first report is the Classification Redesign Report. This report provides us with the opportunity to review our job classification structure and determine how we could better organize the job classifications in order to be more useful and flexible. This would help state agencies and managers more easily identify the appropriate career paths and job families for the work that they do for the state and to help employees in developing their own career paths, and that would help them manage the workforce more effectively. This report focuses on jobs in the AFSCME, MAPE, and middle management, as well as the commissioners and managers plan units. It does not include law enforcement, state residential instructional unit, engineers, or healthcare professionals, since those classification hierarchies are already clear. Lori Hansen is here to review the details of the report.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Lori Hansen, for the record again. Thank you for the opportunity to present the Job Classification Redesign Report. The law outlined three main components. The state's job classification plan should be redesigned and consolidated into no more than 50 job families. The plan must allow for the ability of state agencies to flexibly manage their workforces, and the plan must enhance the ability of state employees to transfer to other positions for which they are qualified. The commissioner is responsible for the administration of the state's job classification plan, whose primary purpose is to describe and document the variety of work performed by state employees. As you probably know, the state has a wide variety of work that is performed, everything from accounting to zookeeping and many other occupations in between. As Ms. O'Brien said, the scope of this project will include job classifications for classified positions in the following categories: the managerial plan, the commissioner's plan, which is the plan that covers unrepresented state employees, and positions covered by MAPE, middle management, and AFSCME bargaining units. This project will cover approximately 1,450 job classifications, or about 95% of the state's job classifications, and approximately 35,000 positions, or about 92% of classified positions. The primary objective of this project is to provide a classification system that is segmented by job families and class series, and which will provide information in a way that logical career paths and classification hierarchies are published and available and will benefit employees and supervisors. Minnesota Management and Budget will coordinate the project, but the project must have the involvement of classification experts from state agencies. The development of a project plan is already underway, and the project is scheduled to end by the end of this calendar year. During the course of this project, other opportunities may be identified, which include creating new classifications or retitling classifications to better describe the work being performed. Mr. Chair, I would be happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned in your opening statements that this job classification or job class, whatever, was going to be for up to 50 job classifications or families. And in the report, it talks about 39 on page 7. It says that each class is assigned to one of 39 existing. So I'm just wondering if you've expanded your families, as you call it, to 50, or why was the original report at 39? Maybe I'm confused.
Mr. Chair, members
yes.
of the committee, that's a very good question. The legislation itself required that we have no more than 50 job families. However, we currently have a system in place where we have identified 39 job families. What we need to do now is go through a process where we re-examine and reevaluate the current state of the 39 existing job families and make decisions about whether or not those are appropriate, whether or not we need to add additional job families, or perhaps we need to consolidate or collapse. So the difference is we already have 39 that exist. The legislation requires no more than 50. And so we will adhere to the no more than 50 requirement in the legislation.
Thank you.
Ms. Hansen, I was the author of this provision in the bill, and it's unfortunate that we didn't have some conversation, I guess, to talk about our real intent here before this report was drafted. And we know the work is now going to carry on for the rest of the year. I'm a firm believer in a good classification system, but I was frankly amazed when I heard that we had 1,450 or 1,500 different classifications, and then we've got another 1,800 subclassifications, and we have a very complex system. And our intent, my intent, was to reduce the complexity of this and question the number of classifications we have. We need a classification system to be fair to our employees, but as you noted already, it needs to be understandable. It needs to be useful, and I don't know how you can, I don't know how anyone can contend that 1,450 classifications, 1,800 subclassifications is useful and understandable. To me, that's just way too complex, way too cumbersome. So I think you need to re-examine what the goals are here. The goals you have are fine. It just doesn't, they don't go far enough in trying to respond to the intent of the bill in the first place. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was hoping maybe we could get some clarification about the correlation between these career family class series and class titles and actual job descriptions on the ground for an individual employee. And so I'll leave it there and then I have a follow-on question. For those of us who maybe have more of a private sector background, is this class title description effectively a job description for an individual person on the ground doing a task, or is there something beyond this class title documentation that provides what we would might typically understand as a job description?
Ms. Hansen?
Mr. Chair, representatives, if I'm understanding the question right, I believe what you're asking about is the exact title of the job classification that a person or a position would hold and whether or not that's descriptive of the job. And the answer to that question is yes, that's the intention of our classification system. There are absolutely thousands of job classifications that exist. There are 1,450 that will be examined as part of this study. And those job classifications, as they exist, are intended to describe the work that is being done within each of those jobs.
Representative Downey.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So thinking about trying to dynamically reestablish job titles and roles and things as we think about redesigning the functions of government and what's going on the ground in these agencies, what's the process for actually changing a class title job description? Does that happen at supervisory discretion, or is this part of collective bargaining, or how and when do those class titles actually get updated and edited to reflect what people are actually doing?
Ms. Hansen?
Mr. Chair and representatives, the job classification or the maintenance of the job classification plan is responsibility of Minnesota Management and Budget. And so during the course of the year, we have requests that come through from state agencies. Typically, they may start at the supervisory level. It is very possible that they start at another level. We work with human resource offices and state agencies. And so those requests will come through us because there is one statewide classification plan. The maintenance of that has to reside somewhere. And so that's handled at Minnesota Management and Budget. We retitle classifications throughout the year. We add classifications. From time to time, we'll realize that we may have one or two classifications that are very, very similar or have become similar, and we will merge those classifications together. So the maintenance is occurring constantly with the classification plan.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what's the interaction between these classification job descriptions and collective bargaining and we hear about steps and lanes and all these tables that set compensation levels. So do each one of these classifications then fit into some kind of category in the actual collective bargaining agreements?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Hansen?
Representatives, that is correct. Every one of the classifications that we create, we say belongs to a bargaining unit. And so under AFSCME, for example, you will have accountants, but you will not have the account clerk class. Let me use that as to be more specific. The account clerk class is an AFSCME class. It is not a, for example, a professional class, or it does not belong to the professional bargaining unit. And so each classification that is created has a home or an owning bargaining unit. Not to say that the class can't be used, for example, under the commissioner's plan, which is really a blend of those classifications.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really helpful. I appreciate that. I think kind of the interaction between job descriptions and collective bargaining and compensation and all that is kind of a big gray cloud for many of us. One final question then. So through MMB and administrative action, different job titles can be and job descriptions can be amended kind of on the fly during the course of a year between collective bargaining cycles. And so there is some movement of people. Collective bargaining doesn't just cast in cement then every person and every job and every job description. MMB is kind of iteratively on the fly during the course of the year, reassigning people and positions and job descriptions into the collective bargaining agreement groupings to set compensation. Is that a fair description?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Hansen?
Representatives, there are two distinct processes. There are certainly things that are negotiated as part of the collective bargaining agreements. As far as the administration of the state's job classification plan, however, the commissioner has the authority to retitle classifications, to create new classifications, or to perhaps delete classifications that are no longer used, and that can be done outside of collective bargaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. That was very helpful.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hansen, you talked about each classification. What's the largest number of people that are in, and what's the smallest number of people are in each classification? That you're talking about 1,450 people that
Ms. Hansen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have many classifications that we refer to as single incumbent classifications, so there are many where there is one individual. It can probably go upwards to classifications where we have maybe a couple hundred employees. For example, think about the transportation workers at the Department of Transportation or the human service technicians at the Department of Human Services. There are many employees in those classifications, so we can go from one to hundreds.
Thank you.
Ms. Hansen, on page 4, at the bottom of the page in the introduction, you talk about the project scope includes approximately 1,450 classifications and approximately 35,000 positions. Nothing is said here about the subclassifications. What is your intent relative to all the subclassifications that there are?
Mr. Chair, at this point, one of the very first steps that we need to take is to take a look at the job classifications themselves. And so the intent of this project was to start at that point. It is not easy to predict, or do we know at this point, until the project gets underway, what the other components of that project might be. But that could be something that we could look at.
Well, as I alluded to, I hope that this effort is not just seen as an opportunity to update and rearrange. In order to be usable and understandable, the complexity has to be reduced, and it seems to me that the number of classifications is just way too high. In terms of job families, whether it's 39 or 50, I would hope that would be attainable, but when you talk about 1,450 classifications, that's a huge number. And if you go back and look at our discussion on this, that was the highlight of our presentation and discussion, that the number of classifications. So I guess I'd like to ask you, and if I need to talk to Commissioner Showalter about it, I will, but I'd like to have some more conversation about some of the goals and scope of this analysis.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Members of the committee, I would like to respond that in our analysis of deciding on the scope of the report and the information that is presented, we did look at the entire classification structure and determined that this is a good starting point for any look at a classification structure going forward. No matter what we do in the future, is to clear up our classification structure, we'll start with this step. So we see this as an important first step in looking at the classification structure as a whole.
But I'm telling you that this language does not correspond with the intent that we had with this. And so I guess maybe I'll have to talk to Commissioner Showalter, because this is not going to do the job that that we intended, I intended to have us accomplish here. Any other questions? If not, thank you. We'll move on to the next report. That's an update on performance appraisal. Again, Ms. O'Brien and Ms. Kuick, is it?
Yes, that's true.
Welcome to the committee, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This report is the Performance Management Report, and it was requested in the 2011 State Government Omnibus Bill, and it asked us to develop a plan for the redesign and implementation of the performance appraisal system for executive branch employees at the agency, program, and individual level. It requires us to make recommendations going forward with a more integrated approach for state agencies. This report reaffirmed for us that our current values of continuous feedback, clarity of performance goals for individuals and for the program, and goal setting is critical to the success of the employee and in the employee performing the work of the organization. It helped us to identify issues to assist us to continue to strengthen the support and direction we give to state agencies as a cornerstone in tying individual performance to agency and organizational strategies. Janine Kuick of Minnesota Management and Budget helped us with the development of this report and is here to detail the report in more depth.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Janine Kuick. I'm the Internal Control and Accountability Director at Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm glad to be here today to talk about the recently issued Performance Management Report. You should have a copy of that report in your materials. As Ms. O'Brien said, in the 2011 State Government Omnibus Bill, MMB was asked to provide a plan for redesign and implementation of the performance appraisal system for executive branch employees. Specifically, the legislation required individual employee performance be evaluated relative to goals for that individual. Programs within agencies be evaluated based on meeting targeted outcomes for those programs, and the evaluation of the performance of entire agencies be evaluated towards meeting targeted outcomes for the agency. And this was pretty good legislation because it really recognized the importance of goal alignment throughout the agencies, from the agency mission all the way down to individual employee performance. And in fact, in our research, we realized that most experts are recommending a cascading type strategic system for work which would link statewide goals through program goals all the way to individual goals and measures. We did find that there's a lot of legislation that already exists relating to performance measurement and performance appraisal. In particular, recently the Commissioner of Administration was asked to develop an integrated long-range plan for the state every 5 years. That first long-range plan, which I don't think you have, but it was issued in 2010, was titled Toward a Vision for Minnesota, Long-Range Strategic Planning Overview and Recommendations. So we have this at the highest level already in place. Budget documents also currently include some performance data, including performance measures for change items in agency budget proposals. And last but certainly not least, We already have a pretty robust system for evaluating employees. There's a law requiring performance appraisals at least once a year for each executive branch employee, with pay increases based on that evaluation. Also, most bargaining agreements and plans require satisfactory or better performance before any progression increases are given. In working on this report, we also found that several state agencies are actively involved already in strategic planning based on their own senior leadership, and they, several of them do strategic planning and measure performance, and we highlight several of those agencies in this report. So, with all of these various initiatives and requirements already in place, we really need to figure out how to coordinate all of these efforts throughout state government. We need to create a vision of how these many performance pieces might fit together and complement each other and create an integrated performance management system. To that end, the report provides three key elements for implementation. Element one is to establish responsibility for performance management standards for the enterprise as a whole and also within each agency. Element two is to develop processes to help agencies determine and periodically report on meaningful performance measures. Element three is to develop management competencies to make sure that supervisors, managers, and senior leaders within agencies have the tools needed to connect agency strategic plans to the work done by individual employees. In conclusion, when I first looked at the legislation, the mandate for a comprehensive performance appraisal system seemed fairly simple and straightforward, but it might be simple on surface, but linking the work of all individual employees to programs and to agency outcomes, I think, is going to be difficult. Creating an integrated set of performance appraisals and managing it successfully will be a long-term and time-consuming process. However, we believe this report has really given us some important first steps. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. O'Brien and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, thank you, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I talked with a group of superintendents in Southeast Minnesota, school superintendents, about the same issue regarding evaluations. And, you know, they assured us that, you know, it's kind of redundant that they had put it in law that we had required now principal and teacher evaluations. And they assured us that, you know, that was something that they were already doing and wasn't sure that the bill was needed. Of course, then I talked to a number of teachers, and one specifically told me that he'd been in a school for 18 years and had two evaluations. Having managed large organizations myself for a number of years, I know one of the most difficult tasks of any supervisor or manager is to do that scheduled evaluation. And although we might have a great program, rarely did I find that I didn't need, as an executive at the top, to remind people that how important it was in order for the organization to both function and to achieve its goals. We got to a point where it was necessary to make sure that the evaluations were coming in and being reviewed by executives to make sure it was clear, first of all, that it needed to get done, and then secondly, that they were being done effectively. There's a couple of things that you said that kind of were red flags for me, and first of all, of course, was that you did an annual. And in my experience, that one evaluation, you know, maybe 30 days prior to you're going to get the evaluation, and that will determine how you did that previous year, is certainly not a program that is going to lead to the results that are anticipated. It usually takes at least a two in a year, a three in a year, a four in a year, so that if there's corrective action needed or redirection, or do you have the resources necessary in order to get the work done? And I didn't hear that, at least, you know, and maybe I'm getting into the weeds a little bit, but I am still quite skeptical of what I've heard, at least so far, that we have a performance system that will lead to the results that we're looking for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, that is certainly true. What I was alluding to is the fact that by law, employees are required to have at least one per year. So the law says that. Clearly, if we were going to look at good management, we know that continuous feedback and continuous realigning of employees is a part of a good, healthy system. So we do recognize that, but the law does require at least one per year.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to add that I agree, Representative, with you. I think that the performance evaluation process is a very difficult process, and I think we found as a result of this report and this analysis that we do have varied compliance with that ongoing performance feedback for employees, and we have certainly improvements to make. But as a result of this report, we have pulled together a couple of state agencies that do have robust performance management systems and goal alignment, and it is our goal to work with them and strengthen that process for those agencies that don't. We also have in process of development, and we have started a couple of leadership management and development modules for the leaders of the organization of the state, and in those it is our goal to teach them about effective performance management, which of course is an ongoing conversation and not just a one-time a year a process. So it is our goal to begin to and continue to train managers and supervisors in goal alignment, identifying effective goals for the employee, and also having continuous conversations and communication with those employees about their performance.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up, and you just helped me a little bit in narrowing down my question, so that you have a model agency that you've looked at or two, you know, that are doing better at the whole evaluation process. Is there any way that you can compile when they were done at the end of their fiscal year to make their performance evaluations, how they ranked in terms of the number that fell into, whether it's excellent, superior, whatever, the number that were in very good, and I'm not sure of your evaluation system, how many categories there are, but to look at how many fell in each one of those categories, was there goals related to how many could go into each one of those categories, and how they compared to the agencies that weren't considered the best. Well, I guess what I found that over the years, unless this is something that is really focused on, there's a whole lot of people that get satisfactory, whether they earned it or deserved it or not. Now, and that's a good and a bad thing. Some of them may not have deserved it because they performed better, but you have a number of employees that if they were given proper attention and resources to perform well, should have gotten a better. And so I guess it's a question about whether or not, and when you do come back, I'd be interested in finding out how well that agency, your benchmark agency, did compared to others. And you don't have to do, you know, all of them, but I would like to see some comparisons if possible.
Ms. O'Brien, did you wish to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in this process of evaluation of employee performance management programs, we do not have a structure in place where we collect information from all state agencies. Because of the diverse functions that they perform, we have let that to several agencies to develop their own performance structures. As a result of this report and the conversations with those agencies with robust processes, we have identified that it is a need for us to develop a stronger infrastructure so that we are able to develop some sort of monitoring tool that we could look at going forward about the success and the progress of our performance management system.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. Who does evaluating? How many evaluators do you have?
Ms. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee, on the evaluation of the employee, the individual employee's direct line supervisor does conduct the employee performance. The robust systems that I referred to in some of the agencies also have a process where they align the goals and the performance of that particular individual to the agency, the program, and the agency goals as well.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the direct supervisor does evaluate. Do you know what the most number that would be that one person would have to evaluate?
Ms. O'Brien.
Chair, Representative, members of the committee. Again, as state agencies, supervisor at different agencies have different numbers of employees, I know that we have some supervisors who have a large number of employees, possibly. I don't know an exact number, but I would. But in corrections, for example, you might have a lieutenant who has several officers to review, maybe 10 or 15, depending on the staffing patterns that they have at each agency.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the beginning of the report, it says that the omnibus bill that was from state government last year, the commissioner was supposed to provide a plan for redesign and implementation of the performance appraisal system for executive branch employees. And then it talks about, you already mentioned and alluded to, that there have been some milestones already set in place by past governors. Governor Ventura had his, and Governor Plenty. And then on the bottom, page 5, it says the governor and the legislative leaders must be involved in goal setting at the highest level, as well as in reviewing and evaluating state agency performance. So I wonder what the timeline is at, and has that been started?
Ms. Cooley?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, it has not been started. And there's some big roadblocks to this. In my research in looking at this global statewide goal setting, a lot of states have struggled with this just because, as I alluded to in the report, each administration comes in with some of their own high priorities, and we have found for this to be a really effective system. Some goals are going to have to transcend individual leadership in that organization or the biennial budget cycle to be able to make sure that certain goals are kind of fixed and long-term, and that employees can gear towards those goals regardless of the current administration or a biennial budget cycle. So that has been one of the things that a lot of other states have struggled with in trying to set up a system that would could be deployed throughout the entire organization.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Ms. Kulik, do you have a time whereby you think that this might be done by the end of this year, by the end of this session, by the middle of next session, or do you have any kind of feel of where that might...
And I'm sorry, Representative, Mr.
Talking about involving the legislature and the governor and setting up this goal setting for reviewing and evaluating the agencies?
Ms. Cooley?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a couple of different ways that we could go here. If you would look on page 4, which is actually the long-range strategic planning overview that the Department of Administration did, they are actually talking about perhaps getting constituent groups involved in that process, getting legislators involved in that process. I think it would really make a difference, depending on what the legislature would like to do, how involved they would like to get in setting big, overarching, enterprise-wide goals for the state of Minnesota. Another way that could happen is we would really just only start with individual mission statements by individual state agencies, and that would be an opportunity for legislators to actually review those mission statements with individual agencies and say, does this make sense? And then agencies could go forward within their organizations based on a mission that was at least discussed and reviewed by the appropriate legislators.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Anderson.
Ms. Kulik, have you had any conversation with the governor or with the leaders of the Senate or the House in regards to this?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not certain what conversations Commissioner Showalter has had. I know he has talked to the governor about this report, but I'm not sure where that conversation is at this point.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question first and then kind of a generalized comment that I'd like to offer. And the question is, in the current collective bargaining process, and I haven't heard anything about this at all on the Employment Relations Commission in our meetings, in collective bargaining, is there any design being built into the new contracts for the provision here that we passed in law that employees not receiving an increase in salary or wages based on progression to another step or lane unless the employee certifies that the employee's performance has been satisfactory. Do you know, are we creating the links in the collective bargaining agreement for the pay side of what we required?
Ms. O'Brien?
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, we currently have language in our collective bargaining, in most of our collective bargaining agreements, that require that progression increases are as a result of satisfactory or greater performance.
Representative Dowling?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good. So we at least have that mechanism, that hook connected. I'll just a quick comment on the report, and others can chime in here on maybe what their intent or their understanding of the intent of the language that we passed was. But I'm just looking at a few things in here. And it says that in some measure that the use of the position descriptions are part of the performance standards in the review process. Certainly not a high degree of standardization or consistency there. Greater than 50%, so around half, say that the use of competencies in annual work plans are being used. So I think some of this is probably what you would expect, right? And that's why we wrote the language to try and tighten this up and make it more consistent. But I think what's also jumps out at me when you look at the action and development plans, you know, hardly anybody, less than 33% of respondents indicated that their agency requires the development of an action plan to achieve employee goals. And we had a lot of discussion last year, and frankly, I and others were criticized pretty severely for proposing things, this included, that was somehow going to be negative or was a negative statement about our employees. And I think what this goes to show, and I'd like to make this comment because I think it's an important one, is that the existing structures and mechanisms that we have aren't really designed to develop employees. And you can see that it's not happening, right? And so the concept that, gee, if we have a performance appraisal system that's actually linked to outcomes, it's going to be so onerous and punitive. And the reverse is actually true. I mean, this does create the opportunity to advise employees on what their development areas are and to set employee development plans and not just have 50 classes that are offered over at admin during the course of the year, but actually tailor a development plan for individual employees and help them build their skills. So I think that's an important observation here, that this isn't just about, you know, hammering performance into the workforce. It's, in fact, in some ways the exact opposite. It's equipping them and empowering them to achieve performance and to grow in their skills and in their jobs. And then I look at the implementation plan, the elements on page 14 and 15, and I got to tell you, maybe there's more detail somewhere with a timeline and deliverables and expectations of who's going to do what. But when I look at what our language requires in terms of actually building these plans and having these things done and actually linking them to the compensation mechanisms in the collective bargaining agreements, I guess I don't really see anything in element 1, 2, or 3 that says we're going to get that done. It kind of seems to me like we're going to think about it and start to equip people. I asked myself a little bit, so what are these managers and supervisors doing? I heard from staff all over the place, workers in our state agencies, that we are so top-heavy, and we have a manager managing a supervisor who then manages the staff, and you know, what are these people doing at that management level? And I know we've got some bills coming to look at that a little more clearly, and I think that's going to be an important discussion this year. But so clearly we've got, it seems to me, we've got management level people all over the place that certainly you could put together a project plan and require them at their kind of position level to collaborate together and actually build these plans, but there's no prescription in here under elements 1 through 3 to get that done. So in my mind, it looks like we did a little bit of diagnosis here and probably didn't learn what we didn't already know, but we documented it, and that's helpful. But the action plan, in my mind, is just wholly inadequate. And with zero accountability, I'd be shocked if when we come back next year that we've actually accomplished the provisions in Section 44. So maybe you can comment on that, but it doesn't seem to me like we're moving forward crisply enough to actually get this done, and we should be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, absolutely. This was kind of the diagnosis stage, and in our research we have found that this is definitely has great merit, and we really need to move ahead on a more concrete level. But at this point in time, we felt like this was a good way to first diagnose and then to say, where do we need to go from here? Your point concerning supervisors or managers, it is important that this also be taken as kind of a development or a learning tool for our leadership within our organizations, with the supervisors, with the managers, to make sure that the management is really assisting employees in their development and clearly understands that that is part of their role as leadership in these organizations. But again, this is a first step. I believe this is going to be an evolution and not a revolution, but clearly we believe that the performance management process is a process that really needs to be reviewed.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just to come in response, I don't think we asked in the legislation for an evolutionary process that we could, you know, watch over the next 10 years. It says this shall be done, and I would have maybe a higher expectation at some point soon to get a clearer plan and a more concrete set of activities and dates and responsibilities to know that we're actually going to get this done instead of agree that it warrants thinking about. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. O'Brien.
Representative, members of the committee, I would just like to respond and say that there are things that we are currently doing that are ongoing in the same direction as this report. I don't want to make it sound like we're not doing anything with regard to this. We currently have a plan that we're in the process of implementing on a competency model that will help managers and supervisors in their talent management and identify those competencies that need to do the work, and that will further be used as a framework for their discussions with the employees about their development. And we also have every intent as a result of this conversation to build a framework for state agencies to address these concerns so that we do have the resources, the tools, and the structure in place to support state agencies so that they can have individual development plan discussions with employees, that they can look at the performance going forward and not just always a back look of the previous year, but to look at what are the things that need to happen in the upcoming year, and that would include what are those development challenges or needs of each individual employee. As you stated, we do have a variety of different practices in state agencies, and it is our intent to take those and use those as best practices and work with the other managers and supervisors and leaders of the agencies to move forward.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, thanks. Ms. Kiewicz and Commissioner O'Brien, first of all, one of the things which looks really interesting to me in this is the paragraph on the Emerging Leaders Institute and the idea that we're going to be doing things to make it possible for the advancement of state employees. I'm kind of interested in what the summation of the work that's being done in this report will lead us to, and I'm much more interested in how we can tie results to input. And so the interest is, I'm not so much interested in some of the specifics you might have on an individual employee as to what that employee ends up accomplishing in terms of the results of part of the institution. And that might be working as part of a group. It might be, it might be some way that we can get, and this was what a lot of our discussion yesterday in the One Minnesota conference had to do with, was how we can really look at the kind of results that are related to input. The other thing that I'm also interested in is the fact I think that state government has been well behind private industry in how we measure work results. And I know, Ms. Kiewicz, this may also tie into your job in with the internal audit division, but how we can tie in work results for a person rather than just seat time in an office, so that we can do much more with telecommuting, we can do much more with flexi time programming and so forth. Can any of this be tied in with this report, so we can go beyond looking at how the workplace performance is being done in the workplace that we have, but how the workplace should be evolving to give us, one, better results, and to give us, two, happier employees, more contented, or whatever the proper word is.
Ms. O'Brien?
Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee, it is, the commissioner has brought together several other commissioners in the development of this report to talk about goal alignment within the, not only at the individual level, but then to tie those goals of the individual to the program outcomes as well as the agency outcomes. And that is where we found some robust systems, for example, at the PCA, where they do have an intricate system to align those goals. What our hope is, again, as a result of this report, that conversation continues to work with those agencies to use those as best practices and implement those systems of assessing that how that performance moves up as in the cascading goals toward better outcomes or more defined and clarity of outcomes for the program and the agency as well.
Well, Representative Chairman, one of the things that was kind of most appalling to me was how we managed our workforce, particularly at the time of the shutdown. And let me talk specifically about the legislature, where the first thing we seemed to do was to put many more people working than I had ever seen before, i.e. people sitting at the desk in the front 24 hours, for all I know, and all kinds of rules. I know Representative Winkler came into this once with his kids, and I came into it with my grandkids, that you weren't allowed going up to your office to get anything. You weren't allowed to take anyone who didn't have an employee identification card with me, except that I found a way to not do it. I was going to give my grandkids to the guy at the front desk and say, by the way, you take care of them, and by the way, they only speak French, so I hope you have a good time. And fortunately, I found something else. I found a way to avoid that. But, you know, I don't think we really understand what's necessary in the workplace and how we can do sensible things about it. And that just, because that was such an extreme situation, it just sort of showed some of the serious, this is also a legislative decision, is that, no, I'm never sure if these are my caucus decisions or your leadership decisions, but that nobody could take vacation time during that period of time, which seemed to me that it was the most sensible time for people to take vacation time. So I don't know how we kind of figure out these things, or how, you know, or how it works on a grander scheme than just, you know, my basic interaction. Oh, yes, also in the revenue building, I think, people had to come in the morning, and then they couldn't leave until, they couldn't leave in the middle of the day to go in and out, and something that also seemed to be something that made no sense. So, you know, when we were doing these things at a time of stress that seemed to make no sense, how do we get to fix things up in normal times?
Ms. O'Brien?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if we can respond to your specific questions, I would be happy to go back and collect some information for you about those situations.
Well, I guess I would be interested.
Thank
you. Guys can talk to your leadership and see if they were the ones who set the rules for the legislature.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're early in this new session, so I'm going to try to be nice about this. But my mom kind of always told me when I was a kid, you know, you got to be careful when you point fingers at other people, and you know, you got three of them coming back at you and stuff. And it just seems appropriate to some of what we're talking about this morning. You know, I don't know that we really evaluate our House staff. We kind of do our own caucus staff to some degree, but I don't know that we do that with our own staff. I don't know that I've seen that in my years here fully. I think they're very professional and good, but I don't know that we've been involved in that. You know, we earlier on we talked about all these classifications. You had 1,400 classifications, 35,000 employees. I'm pretty sure we've got about 300 employees in our own body or somewhere close. And is anybody telling me how many classifications we have? I think we have over 100 classifications ourselves. So, I mean, we got to be careful how we, you know, it just seems really odd to me. And then this last interim, we had, you know, we're having all these nice talks about tailoring employee skills, developing, empowering, and it all sounds good, and treating people good and building them up. And then we had a staff member that was fired and by your team, and I haven't heard really what happened, or I don't know if we're going to have a hearing about it or talk about it or anything, but Ms. Thornton was let go. Was there staff employment problems? Was there staff development that we could have done? Is there good things? You know, we got all these empowering things that were nice things that we're trying to do, and, you know, I'm trying to be nice to Representative Downey. We've had some history, but, you know, I mean, if he's sincere about what he's talking about, here's a case where we canned an employee, and I really don't know what the heck happened, so it'd be kind of nice to talk about it, or at least be honest, and don't treat these, you know, I mean, let's be fair. Let's make sure our own house is in order before we're throwing stones or whatever you want to say. Thank you.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner O'Brien and Ms. Kubik, I just want to go back and make sure I'm getting this right. Every employee has an annual evaluation, correct? They have an annual evaluation, and it's connected to their job description, and their raise, whether or not they get a step increase is connected to that evaluation, right? Is that correct for state employees?
Ms. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representative, each employee is supposed to receive an annual review. We have a variety of compliance with that. It is tied to their job description and their work goals, and they are evaluated on that, and then their performance under most of the contracts and plans require that in order to receive their progression step increase that they would have had a review, and that it would have they would have been identified as having satisfactory or above performance.
Okay. So, Representative Downing and I would agree that if people aren't getting their evaluation, they better get them, and that includes House and Senate employees. One of the things that confused me, and maybe you can shed some light on this, is the talk about legislative leaders and the executive setting goals. And I'm rather confused by that, because I thought when we passed legislation that we set policy. And I thought the executive branch, if the governor signed it into law, then the executive was responsible for fulfilling those policies and carrying them out. And so I just don't understand why we would want legislative leaders meeting with the governor to talk about goals. Because part of that is it's an election, and that's part of the debate, and the governor gets to set his vision for the state, and if the people of Minnesota don't like it, they get rid of the governor. Or if they don't like our vision of the state, they get rid of us. So I'm kind of confused why we would want to muck that all up. And I think it has to do with division of powers here in jurisdiction. So that kind of concerns me, and I'm confused about it. So if you could shed some light on that for me, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we are talking about the terms of the original legislation that was passed. And if you have the report in front of you, if you look at page 2, the third item that we were specifically asked to do is to, required to do is evaluation of the performance of an entire agency towards meeting targeted outcomes for that agency. And I guess the question for all of you is, do you believe that what's currently existing in legislation is sufficient to allow leadership in each agency to clearly understand what the targeted outcomes? And again, if you look at a lot of the research, we have lots of outputs, right? We say this has to happen, that has to happen, and it's all about the numbers. But is everyone clear, and is there a common understanding of what agency targeted outcomes are? And I guess that's more a question for you than it is for us to wrestle with. I think most agencies have come up with their own targeted outcomes predominantly through their individual agency mission statements, and I'm not sure how many of any of you have pursued any individual agency mission statement. But it is this whole notion of targeted outcomes. What was meant by that, and how would we go about figuring out whether we have adequate clarity as to what those targeted outcomes are?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
Just comment. Again, I would hope that the governor's commissioners would have goals for their agencies that reflected the governor's vision of the state and where he wanted to direct it, and why in the world we would, you know, we may disagree with that, but we have our opportunity in legislation to set policy. I'm kind of with Representative Lilly that we have enough issues in our body with staff to I don't know why we'd want to go there and interfere with the executive. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me. And that's part of what contracts are about. And I understand that we're trying to get better performance, and I agree with that. And if the evaluation process isn't doing that, then there needs to be some change to it. And maybe compliance to the law that says annual evaluations will happen. That would be a good first step. And, you know, I knew, and I understand, I didn't work for, you know, I had 60 employees under me, and I knew if they didn't get an evaluation, they were going to knock on my door because their income level depended on that evaluation. So I learned real quickly to be timely. So that would be my thing, but I think we have to be very careful where we're headed here, and what legislative intent is, and versus legislative meddling. But I would say we need to get busy on getting those evaluations done as required by law.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, Representative Kahn brought up the Emerging Leader Program that you mentioned, but I don't know much about that particular program, and I'm wondering if you could, either in comments, tell me about, there's a cost to the agencies when we send people there. I was wondering, who typically attends those? Is it a certain departments or a certain level of employee? And I'm wondering if there's a set curriculum or a certain number of classes that we do. And then, maybe as a follow-up, there's also a Senior Leadership Institute, and I'm wondering what that's all about, and how does that compare and contrast?
Ms. O'Brien.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, thank you for the question. Those are two relatively new programs that we have developed over the course of the last couple years. The Emerging Leaders Institute, I would be happy to provide for you information on what the actual curriculum is. I did not bring that information with me today. But the participants in that are recommended by their agency leadership, and they go through a process of selection where they apply to participate with the recommendation of their leadership. And then those individuals participate in a middle manager, so to speak, emerging leader capacity training that discusses all of these types of topics and to develop them into being better managers going forward. The Senior Leadership Institute that we're very proud of, has just started. And in that case, we're looking at is a succession plan for the new leaders for the organization going forward. And that is a higher level, again, recommended by their current leadership, go through a selection process. There is a cost for the agency for both of those programs. And that is something that has just started, and we have several individuals who are very excited about participating in that as a succession plan. And to talk about what it does a leader in state government need, what are the competencies that a state leader in, need to have. And so it talks about those types of things. And again, I can get you that information about the actual curriculum if you desire.
Yeah, thank you. That'd be great.
Well, members, we have a couple more reports to go through here, but I just want to say, and sort of a little bit of a summary here of this discussion, we ought not, as a legislature, be about micromanaging. The last thing we ought to be trying to do is to tell MMB or anybody else how to do their job. But we need an ongoing discussion about what the intent was to make sure that the intent that we had is actually being implemented and followed. And so I hope this discussion underscores the importance of that. And as we have an ongoing dialogue about intent, if there are things we need to clarify, then we need to clarify. If there are adjustments that the administration needs to make, then we hope that they would do that as well. So please take this from my standpoint as a call not to micromanage, but to make sure we follow and are attuned to the intent that the legislature had as we move forward. So thank you very much, Assistant Commissioner Ms. Kiewicz.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
And the Assistant Commissioner is going to be here for the next report as well.
Yes.
And we have a couple others who are joining us for that. If someone wants the this is the full report, folks. If any of you are hungry for bedtime reading, you may have at it here. So, Assistant Commissioner, you want to start it off and then have each of the folks introduce themselves?
I will. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the last report we have for you today is the total compensation report. I'd like to give you a little background on the report. The original purpose of the report was to respond to requests from the legislature regarding information on employee staffing and individual salaries for executive branch employees. MNSCU is not included in this report. A decade or so ago, we used to provide employee rosters with the actual budget documents. Now we produce the report and post it on our website annually so that it is available for anybody who is interested in the information. This report is a snapshot in time of employee salary and fringe costs. The report details the projected costs for the upcoming calendar year for those employed as of the date of the report, and for this year's report, it's January 11th, 2012. It does not include analysis of the data. I have with me today Charlie Bielek of Minnesota Management and Budget to help us answer any questions you might have, and Chad Tuohy of Minnesota Management and Budget, who is going to discuss the details of the report.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Please,
good morning, Mr.
identify
Chair.
Yourself for the record.
Absolutely. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Chad Tuohy, and I'm the State Compensation Manager with Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you and present some information about the total compensation report. I believe you have copies of summaries of this report in your packets. The report for you today, before you today was as the result of a law that was passed in 2001, which required a report to the legislature on executive branch salaries and benefits. The purpose of the report is to assist in long-range planning, and the report has been generated since 2002. The report, as Ms. O'Brien outlined, annualizes salaries and estimates benefits of employees that are in place on a date close to January 15th, which corresponds to the date the report is due, and projects those salaries and benefits going forward for the remainder of the calendar year. The legislature subsequently passed a law in 2006 requiring that the total comp report must also include specific information on retirement plan membership, and so that's why that piece is included in the report. The report consists of the following. Salary, hourly wage estimate for 2012, and you have those numbers. You have the three-page summary of, I believe, the reports going, the last five or so reports from 2008 forward. In 2012, the salary hourly wage estimate was $1.649 billion. You have an insurance estimate of $340 million. I won't go through all these numbers. You have a FICA estimate, a retirement estimate, a deferred comp estimate, and a health care savings plan estimate. The total estimated compensation projected for 2012 is $2.218 billion. The report also includes a summary by agency of the projected total comp expenses broken down by the categories I just mentioned, a summary by agency of the count of employees by retirement plan participation, and then, as the chair indicated, that the ream of paper in front of him is largely a list of employees by name and agency that includes the job title and the annual projected percentage of full-time equivalent, along with the individual expenditure estimates of the salary, insurance, FICA, and so forth. And so you have every state employee individual salaries and benefits in that report projected for 2012. It's important to note that this does not tie back to actual expenditures, nor does it make any assumptions about expenditure increases or decreases. Rather, it's simply a projection of cost based on a snapshot in time, and it assumes that if nothing changes, that the expenditures for the year will be as indicated on the report. The estimate for 2012 is 1.14% less than 2011, and it's 1.29% less than that which was projected for 2009. And so the projected costs have gone down in recent years. The hourly rate and insurance benefits are set in bargaining agreements and plans that are approved by the legislature, and the main drivers of increases or decreases, as the case may be, are the existence of across-the-board increases, step increases, insurance increases, or decreases. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Down.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I'm struggling to tie your numbers to the report summary that we have in front of us. And you mentioned something about some billion for 2012. Where is that on the paper copies that we have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, that's actually, you'll see grand totals for each of those categories I mentioned, the salary and benefits, the insurance, the deferred comp. If you add those numbers up across the bottom on the third page, the grand total is $2.218 billion.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And so the heading on the first page I have is from Friday, January 14th, 2011. So that's like a year ago. Is there a 2012 page? Maybe that's where I'm getting hung up.
Mr. Thuy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, yes, there is a report that was issued for 2012. The top of the date at the top is January. Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, yes, there is a report that was issued for 2012. The top of the date at the top is January 11th, 2012. And I apologize if that's missing from your packet. We can certainly get that for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That explains my confusion. Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our last report for today is a report on CGIP, State Employee Group Insurance Program. Mr. Morocco. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division, and I was asked to provide an update to the dependent eligibility verification audit that we were required to conduct as part of the agreement under last session. Again, thank you for the opportunity to come and provide an update. Just as a refresher, the State Employee Group Insurance Program is comprised of about 50,000 state employees with about 70,000 dependents. And we have we're comprised of the legislature, the judicial branch, executive branch, MNSCU, and other sort of quasi-state agencies. The legislation required that we enter, that we issue a request for proposal by October 1st. We're happy to let you know that we were able to do that by August 22nd. And we received three responses from Aon Hewitt, Sokovia, and HMS. Each of the vendors were very reputable, had a lot of experience, so we were very pleased that we had good vendors to select from. The legislation required that we enter into a contract by January 1st of 2011, and we were able to do so on December 29th, and we did that using the vendor HMS. So I'll provide just a quick background on the vendor, and then be happy to take any questions you may have. HMS, I believe they're headquartered out of Indiana. They've done many audits. They've performed 700 audits, including about 2.5 million lives. They have and were required as part of the RFP to demonstrate experience in both the private, but more importantly, the public sector. They have done all kinds of school districts, unions, hospitals. Specifically, as it relates to states, they've done the state of Kentucky, Maine, Iowa, and Colorado. They've also done other large companies like Walt Disney, Honeywell, Anheuser-Busch, et cetera. And really one of the main reasons we had selected this vendor was, that they really had both a high level of security that we were looking for. We certainly recognize the sensitivity around dependent audits. And there was also really a high level of respect, for the members that they were auditing. So those are really kind of two key components from our perspective, is that, we will be asking members to hand over important documents. We want those documents to be handled securely, and we want those documents to be handled respectfully. In terms of the status of the audit, so again, we entered into the contract at the end of last year. We've had one or two meetings so far with the vendor. The intent would be that we would have about a 30 to 60 day planning period, and at which point, and it looks like we probably will use a full 60 days for the planning. We will initiate the audit around March 1st, sometime in early March. We would anticipate approximately 11 weeks to conduct the audit, with the intent of then having the full audit ready, really completed in time for the upcoming fiscal year. So we would expect all changes as a result of the audit to occur by July 1st of this year. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. I don't have a lot of details as we are in the planning phase right now, but we're very pleased with the selection of the current vendor, and even during this planning process, everything has been very positive and has been progressing to our liking. So with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, we've had an ongoing discussion about this, and this was one of those things that was passed after we had the shutdown, and I just want to be reminded exactly how this was structured. A couple things. Did the vendor testify? We had some testimony during committee around this bill. Was he one of the testifiers, or was that the company one of the ones that testified? And then I have a couple other questions.
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe it was Mr. Henry Van Dellen from Aon Consulting Company was the testifier. They were one of the entities that had submitted but did not receive the winning bid. Again, just as all of the vendors were excellent, and frankly, we would have been confident with any of the vendors, but this one ultimately did rise to the top of our RFP.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My other question was, remind us of the cost structure of this. Was there is there some kind of reward for the amount of people that are found out of compliance, or the number? How is the cost structured of the contract?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the language that was passed allowed for an option for a performance-based audit. However, through the RFP process, and we did hold that out as an option, However, through the RFP process, we determined that that was probably not the best route to go. Ultimately, either you have the documents to demonstrate that these are valid dependents or you don't. And we didn't really see the need, nor was there really any financial incentive for us to go to performance-based. It likely would have resulted in a higher cost for the audit and probably a reverse incentive, from a vendor perspective, from a program perspective. We simply wanted things to be more black and white.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Slaughter.
Thank you. I'm actually glad to hear that because I think that it seemed a little bit troubling to have a performance-based structure for that. I just have one last question, Mr. Chair, and that would be around compliance, what happens? You know, when we bid out our state health plans and you hear the governor talk about the Commissioner of Human Services and how she had done the rebidding process and how we're saving a lot of money. But in that process, there are people that lost benefits to their insurance. For example, folks that had a very, what was expensive form of autism coverage called ABA. Now Blue Cross is no longer going to offer that as an option, period. When you look at, with compliance here, Mr. Morocco, what happens if they're not complying? Is it immediately dropped off of insurance? Is there a complaint process? These are going to be our constituents that could be coming to us talking about, I've been audited, this is what happened, I don't agree with it. What's the process?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative, what we anticipate first off, is multiple notification process on the front end. We would anticipate something like three direct communications to the member's home, indicating who the dependent that we have listed is and the kinds of documents that would likely validate their eligibility. We would also anticipate some communications coming out from us, either from the program, perhaps commissioners, perhaps even from the governor. That said, we certainly are anticipating that there will be members that will either ignore the letters or somehow fail to receive them. So both as part of standard practice as well as required by the legislation, there will be an appeal process. So ultimately, if somebody does fail to respond to the notifications, they will be dropped. That really will sort of be their notice, I suppose, when they go to the doctor and suddenly realize that, all those letters that they were receiving actually were important and needed to be responded to. They will then likely contact us or perhaps the vendor. Again, we're in the planning phase, so I'm not sure exactly what the appeal process will be, but there will be an appeals process at which time then there would be an opportunity to then demonstrate the eligibility of the dependent, and then re-enrollment can then occur.
Mr. Chair, just two more things. One would be, Mr. Morocco, as we go through that process, how much did the actual contract cost? And then are you going to be able to estimate how much we saved or how many people? I'd like to know how much we saved potentially by this and then how many people lost insurance. When would we know that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, certainly by July 1st, we'll know how many people have dropped off. I'm not sure how long it will take to actually go through the appeals process. The range of savings in our, in our research at the time that the legislation was being introduced was a savings anywhere between maybe 3% and 8%. So it does range considerably. It was one of the challenges in terms of, really coming up with a good cost estimate. But so I would say by July 1st, we'll know probably the maximum that we could save, that being if all of those people dropped and they were all dropped for legitimate reasons, that would sort of be your maximum savings that you could achieve. We know that every member on a sort of a per member basis or, a per year, per month, we know what every member costs us in the program. So we'll just simply take the number of drops. We know that we can even break that down by age categories and gender categories. So we can come up with a pretty good estimate. But that would be your maximum range. And then what I would anticipate is that the appeals process will bring people back onto the plan. And how long that will take, certainly it would be reasonable to say by the following open enrollment. So let's say 6 months later. So if we do this drop on July 1st, people will, through the course of the year, then become aware that they've lost their eligibility and will attempt to come back on the plan. Or I would think the next opportunity would be at open enrollment, where we re-communicate eligibility, we re-communicate who is and is not enrolled. I suspect that's probably the next opportunity that people will become aware. So I would say we would have probably a definitive number, you know, by January 1st of 2013.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Slaw. So I would hope we would have, you know, we're not sure we're going to have the same committees in January of 2013. They might be, look a little bit different, but hopefully we would have some kind of report at that point. How much are we paying for this, Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't have the exact amount. I believe it's somewhere south of $500,000.
Thank you.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, pardon my ignorance on all of this, but under the new federal health care law, I know the age for dependent coverage went up. Does that impact our CGIP coverage, and have you seen an uptick in dependent eligibility counts as a result of that?
Representative Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, the Accountable Care Act does impact CGIP. It did allow for dependents to be added up to age 26, regardless of student status, and we did see an increase in enrollment as a result of that. It is one of the components that makes estimating the cost savings a challenge, because all of the information as part of our research last year sort of predated, you know, the ACA. So a lot of the savings that had been achieved in prior audits were a result of, you know, requiring student eligibility and would have been occurring at a lower age. So we suspect that our results will be lower because of the ACA, but we don't know.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so is it fair to say that actually your letters going out might actually trigger people who are eligible for coverage but aren't aware of it, would actually sign up as a result of this?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it certainly could make people newly aware. However, they wouldn't actually be able to add until they, probably until the following open enrollment, so until you know, November of 2012 in preparation for January 1st of 2013. But just the act of getting a letter doesn't allow you to add a dependent.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco, what would be really interesting for me, and maybe you can say whether or not you're planning to kind of slice the dollars this way in your final report, it'd be interesting to me to see what the impact of the federal law is in terms of an increase on the cost of our dependent coverage at the state, and kind of net out, if you will, the difference between that and the savings that we've achieved by cleaning up ineligible dependents and getting them off the rolls. We're going to see kind of a mash of that data together when we look at the total number at the end. I'd be curious to see what the savings were from the dependents that we cleaned up off the rolls as compared to the dependents that came on either by virtue of your process or just in general. That's an interesting number to me, to see what the new cost of the eligibility dependent age increase is to the state.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Morocco, in December we talked about every employee is going to be part of this audit. Is that correct?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative, every dependent or every employee who carries dependent coverage, which is roughly 60% of the population.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
And we also talked about supporting documents like birth certificates, divorce decrees, naturalization papers. And at that time I asked you how long that those were going to be held, and you weren't sure of that. And I'm wondering if you've come to a conclusion how long you need to hold those copy of those documents.
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't have an answer for that. That is certainly part of the planning phase. The legislation that was passed anticipates a recommendation from the vendor about how to manage eligibility ongoing. So I would anticipate that that would be part of the discussion. To the extent that 5 years down the road somebody needs to redemonstrate the eligibility, are we going to ask them to resubmit documents that they've already submitted, or would we perhaps keep those things on file? Again, those will be key decisions for us as we move through the next 30 to 60 days.
Mr.
Representative Gauthier.
Mr. Morocco, concerning those documents, for example, a birth certificate, which hopefully most people have their children's birth certificates, would you accept a Xerox copy, or do we have to have a legitimate birth certificate issued by the county where the birth took place?
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative, again, those are the types of details that the planning period is intended to identify, not only the kinds of documents, but, you know, sort of in what form do they need to take. I would suspect, however, though, because documents can be emailed and faxed and so forth, you know, that as long as it has the proper authorization on the document, whether it's a copy, I think is probably going to be fine.
Okay.
Mr. Gauthier?
Mr. Morocco, in December I also talked about costs that's incurred by employees providing these documents. And is there anything in this process where you are going to follow those expenses incurred by employees? Because I think that's part of what we need to be responsible for. I mean, we're going to spend almost $500,000 on this audit. We're going to save some money. But are we going to also chart what it costs our employees to be compliant? Because I think that's an expense that we need to be aware of what we're asking employees to do and how that affects them.
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we certainly didn't anticipate that. I would be happy to consider that as part of a final component to the final report.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gauthier.
Mr. Morocco, I would appreciate if you would to compile that information, because I think it's important for us to see that.
Any further questions? Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, Representative Gauthier, you might be interested in joining me on a bill where the cost to our small business owners of their compliance activities with unwarranted sales tax audits, we at least should probably track that information, too. It'll be a great bill.
I'll talk to you.
I think that's a yes.
No, that's not a yes. Good try, though, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Morocco, for the update, and we look forward to ongoing updates as to how things are proceeding. Members, you probably noticed that our committee LA is no longer with us, John O'Neill. We have, as her replacement, Peter Glessing. Peter's located in the same place outside my office and Mr. Marple's office. We're delighted to have him with us, and he has a tremendous background that is going to be very helpful to us as a committee. So welcome. And for next week, members, on Tuesday we're going to hear from the Department of Administration on several RFP updates that they have going on, and we're going to start hearing some other bills. And then on Wednesday, we've got State Auditor coming for some presentations and, again, some bills. And as you know, given our schedule, we are not meeting on Thursday. That's the beginning of our so-called precinct caucus break, which starts next Thursday, a week from today. Representative Slavik. Yeah,
Mr. Chair, I just had a question. In the interim while we were off, there was a lot of news coverage about sick time of state employees and the accumulation and all of that. Are we going to be getting into that topic at all?
I'm not aware of anything that's coming forward on that.
Just something we might want to think about, Mr. Chair. I think I can't remember. Did the Senate have a hearing on that? There might have been something. But with everybody being concerned about costs, it was... We might want to take a look at.
Well, we'll check and see what's happening there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other, Representative Green?
Mr. Chair, I wondered if you had an update on Jana and her baby.
No.
Oh, everyone's doing well.
Great.
And she had the baby came a little later, but everybody's doing well. The last we've heard, so. If no further business, we stand adjourned. Ooh.